This is Juliet.
And this is Leisha.
And welcome back to the Screen Tea Podcast. Week we're doing a movie that I have seen and Leisha has not seen, and I have talked about it a lot, and I finally got the opportunity to make her watch it. I am currently drinking just straight up chamomile tea. What are you drinking?
I have a really interesting vanilla honey chamomile.
So we're both going to fall asleep before we're done.
No, I don't think so. It won't be as bad as last week.
Yeah.
When we were recording really late and we were exhausted. The kids are already asleep. It's not our bedtime yet.
No, not yet.
So it shouldn't be quite as bad.
Nope.
Nope. So with this being Juliet's, kind of Juliet's week to show me something new, I'm going to let her go ahead and kick us off after she takes this big old slurpy tea there.
It's too hot. I can't.
It is really hot.
Not yet.
Yes. All right. And whenever you are ready, what did we watch this week?
We watched a movie that I thoroughly enjoy called Stardust. Yeah, it was released in August 10th, 2007. It was directed by Matthew Vaughn, who is also known for Layer Cake, Kick-Ass, X-Men First Class, and all three of the Kingsman movies. It was written by Vaughn as well as Jane Goldman, and she is known for Kick-Ass, X-Men First Class, as well as Days of Future Past, The Kingsman, The Secret Service, and The Gold Circle, and the upcoming Little Mermaid movie. It was produced by the companies were Paramount Pictures, Marv Films, Vaughn Productions, D. Bonaventura Pictures, excuse me, and Genius Films Partners, and True North Productions. Some of the individual producers are Lorenzo D. Bonaventura, Michael Dreyer, Chantal Fahali, Neil Gaiman, as that is the author of the book that this movie is based off of, Stephen Marks, Peter Morton, Tarquin Pack, Chris Thykier, Matthew Vaughn, and David Womack.
Okay. Was that fun for you?
That was a lot. It was like a tongue twister.
You did pretty good. You did good.
All right.
Sorry. Cinematography was done by Ben Davis. Oh, and then I get just a dude named Ben Davis. I feel cheated of the tongue twisters. Other notable films where he did cinematography or was the DP was Kick-Ass, Guardians of the Galaxy, Doctor Strange, Captain Marvel. What do these things have in common?
Oh, plus other Marvel movies. Nice. I just didn't list them.
Okay. Three Billboards Outside Ebbing, Missouri. Awesome. It was edited by John Harris, who also has credits for The Descent 1 and 2, Kick-Ass, I noticed theme here,
yes,
and Kingsman, The Secret Service, yes, continuing the theme.
Mm-hmm.
Soundtrack and composing was by Ilanish Cary, whose other film credits include Layer Cake, Hannibal Rising, oh boy, that's a movie, and Kick-Ass, go figure.
Yeah, a bunch of everybody that worked on this movie has worked on a bunch of other movies with Matthew Vaughn, including the cast, which you're about to find out.
Yeah, I really kind of dig it when you can tell when a director finds their people.
Yeah.
Like, finds their crew.
Mm-hmm.
So, cool. I'm going to kick us off here with the beginning of the cast. This movie starred a little baby Charlie Cox, oh boy, as Tristan Thorne. I know Charlie from Daredevil. Specifically,
I know Charlie from this.
He is just so adorable in this. I was delighted. He's known for Daredevil, Defenders, The Theory of Everything, and Casanova. This movie also stars Claire Danes, who played Yvain. She is also known for My So-Called Life, the TV show Homeland, Romeo and Juliet, and The Hours. Mark Strong, who played Septimus. He's known for 1917, Shazam, Kingsman, Secret Service, Zero Dark Thirty, and Sherlock Holmes.
And so many other things.
I mean, yeah, everyone so far that we've noted, as well as next up, Michelle Pfeiffer, known for just so many other things.
Just like three of the main people are just in everything.
Right. Michelle Pfeiffer played Lamia. She's known for Hairspray, What Lies Beneath, which just kind of asterisk there. One of my favorite Michelle Pfeiffer movies. One Fine Day and The Age of Innocence. And Jules, you want to round up the cast for us?
Next up we have Robert De Niro, which he was in episode 2 of The Joker. He plays Captain Shakespeare. He's again known for Cape Fear, Raging Bull, Taxi Driver, and Mean Streets. We have Sienna Miller, who plays Victoria, who is known for G.I. Joe, Rise of Cobra, American Sniper, Layer Cake, and The Lost City of Z. We have Sir Ian McKellen, who plays the narrator, who is obviously just known for all of the things, mostly Lord of the Rings, The Hobbit, and X-Men are the big ones, at least in this household, I believe.
Yes.
And then we have Jason Fleming, who plays Primus. He is known for all of the long-named movies.
Holy shit, you're not wrong.
Yeah. The Curious Case of Benjamin Button, Lock, Stock, and Two Smoking Barrels, The League of Extraordinary Gentlemen, and The Short One from Hell. Some actor notes here. When co-writer and director Matthew Vaughn pitched this movie to executives at Paramount Pictures, the studio wanted a more recognizable name like Orlando Bloom to play Tristan. It was only after Vaughn had cast Robert De Niro, Michelle Pfeiffer, and Claire Danes in the movie did Paramount agree that to let Vaughn cast Charlie Cox as Tristan.
Oh,
and
then
a part two to that kind of note is that Vaughn insisted on an unknown actor for the part of Tristan. Cox was tentatively cast as Tristan, but to ensure that the lead had chemistry, Vaughn would not confirm the casting until both leads were cast. Charlie had to audition alongside prospective leading actresses until the female lead, which ended up being Danes, was cast. Sarah Michelle Gellar was offered the role of Yvain among other actresses, but turned it down to spend more time with her husband, Freddie Prinze Jr.
Oh, Freddie.
I think ScarJo was actually also in the running to play Yvain.
Instead of Claire.
And I think Jessica Alba was also listed, and some other people. There's a lot of people.
I'm glad that they wound up with Claire Danes.
Yeah, I am too.
Awesome. So this film, the budget was $65 million. It earned at the box office $137 million, so a definite success. Reception, so it's interesting here. I didn't really get a good look at the numbers before right now. Critically, Rotten Tomatoes aggregated score for critics was a 77%. Metacritic was a little bit lower, which we've come to expect, sitting at a 66%. Audience-wise, on Rotten Tomatoes, 86%, which is the highest kind of level of reception. On IMDb, a 7.6 out of 10 was given.
It doubled its profit, but it wasn't considered successful enough for a potential sequel. He wanted to make a second one, Vaughn, but...
Really?
Mm-hmm.
Once again, I'm kind of glad that didn't happen, because I'm assuming this is just me speaking out of my ass because I don't actually know. I'm assuming there's no sequel to the book?
I have no idea.
Okay.
But Neil Gaiman and Matthew Vaughn are very good friends, and that was one of the reasons Gaiman actually handed the rights over for free, because he trusted Vaughn so much with the rights in the movie.
Well, I don't really necessarily know how a part two would be made.
I don't know.
Huh. I'm not, you know, saying I'm glad that it wasn't a big enough financial success not to warrant a second one, but on the same hand, I'm glad that there isn't a second one.
Yeah, I like this movie. I don't know how a second one would have been.
Exactly.
The movie is 2 hours and 7 minutes, which is a total of 127 minutes. It's Dolby Digital for sound. The aspect ratio is 2.35 to 1, which is basically your movie theater widescreen. So when you go and see a movie theater, That's that aspect ratio. If you watch a movie with that aspect ratio at home, you're going to have the black bars on top and bottom. The cameras they used were Panavision cameras and lenses, which is that anamorphic style that I mentioned in the first episode, which is the super wide lens, and it has an oval kind of aperture instead of the circle aperture. So like your eyeball, your pupils is a circle, so you would instead have an oval pupil. That's kind of the comparison. The cinematographic process was digital.
Sorry, Emily's shaking my
head.
Yeah,
I can't say anything tonight. I can't talk.
Cinematographic?
There you go. Sure. We'll go with that. As digital intermediate, which is 2K master format. Panavision is the source format. Basically, it means that it was shot anamorphically with Panavision cameras and lenses, and then the film negative, which was 35mm, was then scanned at 2K resolution for post-production. That's what all that fancy talk is.
Okay, thank you for explaining that. This is, the fancy talk is what I am absolutely goddamn clueless about, so.
Me too, sometimes.
I...
Because there's a lot to it.
Well, sure, but you're the one with kind of the educational background in it all, so I appreciate the...
Putting my money to good work.
There you go. No sarcasm. I sensed none of it. All right. So, with this being your movie and you not talking enough during these podcast episodes.
This is your project.
I don't know about that.
Anyway.
I don't know. I'm going to let you just kind of lead the format.
Oh, but I'm so bad about that. I'm really good at just kind of working off you. But anyway, I really want to read the book. I've watched this movie so many times and I've never read the book. I'm really bad at reading. But I'm kind of curious about how the book is formatted with how this movie has like three different perspectives. Is it three?
Like main storylines?
Yes.
Main plots?
Yes.
Well, we have Tristan and Yvain. Mm-hmm. That'd be one.
Septimus is two.
Septimus would be two. Lamia.
It's three. So there's three. There's a fun fact that Lamia is not a major character in the books. She's a minor character. So I'm curious as to how the book's formatted. Because this in the beginning, this movie's kind of all over the place because it's trying to kind of, I think, set a bunch of stuff up. It's setting so much stuff up that it kind of bounces a little bit, I feel, direction-wise. Just to establish everything before continuing on with the plot. I don't know if you noticed that at all. Or...
Yeah, I mean, I struggled with making, kind of noting things direction-wise for this film because nothing really particularly stood out to me as being fantastic or as being, like, very flawed. And it might be because this is an adaptation, mm-hmm. as you had mentioned, and Gaiman tends to write stories that I generally like, and the structure of his stories is generally pretty solid. So if it followed his adaptation and plot setup and character setup and things like that, I'm not really surprised that nothing stood out as being inherently flawed direction-wise. Mm-hmm.
I feel like you can feel that there's a lot of ground that needs to be covered and they don't necessarily, they're covering as much as they can in the amount of time that they've been allotted.
Sure.
Which I feel is just very typical of the fantasy genre.
Yeah, and this is like not exactly my kind of film.
I know.
Right, which, and I'm sure that anyone who decides to listen to this nonsense, will get the feeling as we continue and kind of get to know that about me. I did find myself a little bit surprised that I didn't have more commentary on the direction because I really like most of Vaughn's other work that he's directed. Mm-hmm. And I don't really know if it's maybe because I'm used to seeing what he does with more like cutting edge tech or like huge budget, fast paced, you know, choreographed fighting, violence present kind of in the other films led me to expect something different from him. But he made a fine movie, but consider me kind of just not surprised that it was only his second kind of foray into directing. Mm-hmm. It seemed kind of like a sophomore effort.
Hmm.
Yeah.
I thought it was pretty, it's very like dialogue heavy and kind of in your face with explanations, I think it tends to weigh it down a little bit mm-hmm. and kind of mess with the pacing, which is a little bit into the writing. I love this movie, which will be made apparent throughout this podcast. I really enjoy the dark humor. It's kind of dry and quick. There's a lot of physical humor, especially with like when you have all of the princes together. Mm-hmm. I like it. I really enjoy the whimsy.
Yeah, not all the whimsy had me cringing, which was kind of nice. Mm-hmm. I struggle with whimsy a lot. So as far as like writing goes, I've not read the novel. And I definitely feel the writing needs to be credited not only to Jane Goldman and Matthew Vaughn, who wrote the screenplay, but obviously also to Neil Gaiman, who created the original story and characters. And it feels very much like a Gaiman story. It's fantastical. There's that little twist of darkness to it, and surprisingly natural and biting bits of humor, mm-hmm. which is why I probably didn't mind the whimsy so much, because it was a little darker, because it was a little biting.
Mm-hmm. Another note is I feel like a lot of what could be like serious fighting or arguing between characters is replaced with humorous bickering.
Yeah.
And I don't know, I really enjoy so much of this film.
You enjoy sassiness.
I do.
There were some points in time where I definitely give kudos to the screenplay writers. They took to task the job of transcribing one of Neil Gaiman's stories onto the screen. However, I did have to wonder if some of the lines of dialogue came across as being so cringy in the books. Like, if it's a word-for-word kind of dialogue adaptation.
I'm going to say no.
Probably very rarely does that happen. But oh my goodness, there was some hardcore cringe that I was feeling with some of the dialogue. And that can be attributed, of course, to the writing, to the direction, or to the acting. But some of the lines, like, I was, like, internally and externally, groaning and, like, rolling my eyes a little bit.
I'm sure I caught some of that.
Oh, I'm sure you did.
But do you have examples or no? Are those later on in your notes?
I don't know if I wrote them down. I really don't. Just some of it was very... just like people don't talk like this type of examples, like who says that, this hurts me.
I feel that way with fantasy in general
sometimes. Yes,
I mean, it's, I think you're supposed to get that sense that it's not of our world. Well, and that's a way that they try to portray that.
Yeah, but I don't struggle with all fantasy.
I know.
There's a difference between the kind of cringy dialogue in this film as opposed to, you know, The Hobbit or Lord of the Rings or Game of Thrones, mm-hmm. or, you know, that I don't really get the hardcore cringe. But it might have to do with also the underlying romantic feel nature of this film as well.
Yeah.
But, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Do you want to get into characters?
Sure. Tristan.
Fun fact. Tristan in the book is Tristran.
Tristran?
Mm-hmm. So it is T-R-I-S-T-R-A-N.
Tristran.
Tristan. And they changed it because, as we can hear, it's hard to say.
That is very difficult. Yeah, Tristran. That's a lot of consonants in a row.
And Charlie Cox actually makes a reference to that at some point in the movie.
Oh, really?
Mm-hmm.
I must have glossed over
it. I glossed over it until I read it and I was like, oh yeah, he totally does.
Huh. Okay. This child, he's not a child, but I think it's just seeing, you know,
this dorky little dude who becomes Daredevil.
Yeah, like Matt Murdock. Who I know is Matt Murdock, just this baby faced young little child. So something that I do appreciate about the character of Tristan is he falls into patterns that we typically see in female characters mm-hmm. when we watch a lot of films. So he falls for the asshole in the film, mm-hmm. who's played by Sienna Miller. And he's the one who's willing to fall over himself and do ridiculous things for them. Seeing a male in this role was kind of an interesting change of pace. That being said, as endearing as that makes Tristan, he's also a giant douchebag. Like, yeah. For most of the film, I think.
Why do you like Victoria? She's a dick to you. Are there no other women is literally my note.
Exactly, yes. Or is it just because she's pretty? Like, I don't know. But he wants to impress this woman so badly that he is willing to trap a woman. Like, yeah, sure, she's a fallen star. But he's willing to trap her to kind of bequeath as a gift to another woman. And in my mind, I'm just like, yeah, that's slavery and or human trafficking, regardless of your statement that you're going to use your candle and maybe send her home. Like, you can't just give people to other people, you dingus. That's not how people work. And so, like, I have a lot of mixed feelings about him throughout this film. As you know, oh, aren't you cute? Oh, aren't you just a fucking idiot, asshole, douchebag?
My descriptor of him is, what a little pup turned proper hero, surprise prince.
See, I don't know. So, proper hero, I think maybe by the end.
Yeah,
he has a turning point. He evolves into that. He does. He makes the right call, obviously realizes perhaps he should stop trying to woo this woman who doesn't even like him.
And has such, so like my next is just, he has such big goals and a sense of adventure, and he's trying to impress this woman that thinks, I don't even know where Ipswich is, but apparently it's nothing special.
Right.
She thinks it's this special thing. He's like, no, no, dream bigger.
Yeah.
Because I dream bigger. It's just like, that should tell you right there.
Right.
She's not for you.
Like, yeah, that should. However, I kind of finally start cheering for him very late in the film, and that's literally when he drops Victoria on her ass. When, you know, he's, like, dipping her and tells her to grow up, and that's when I finally start liking him. Which I still, verdicts out for me if that's too late in the film, because throughout the majority of it, I'm just like, you are annoying.
And that could be, like, the kind of, it's not the very start of the third act, but it could be, it's, like, near the, I mean,
yeah.
I'm sure there's other books, movies, plays, whatever, where you don't, that doesn't happen until the third act.
Well, sure, I mean, there are other, look at fucking, like, Severus Snape. You don't really know how you're supposed to feel about him, how the author wants you to feel about him. And I know this is a controversial kind of topic that's only related in, like, story and character structure, but until this dude's, like, literally
dying,
like, yeah, like, kick in the bucket.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't know, there was the, you know, Tristan's endearing. But just his whole thought of, I'm going to give this woman as a gift to the woman I actually love. It just, it's, what did I say yesterday? It's just, it's ookie.
Ookie, yeah, I made fun of you because you're saying.
Gives me an ookie feeling.
Ookie. And then next we have Yvain, who's a star.
Literally and figuratively.
She's actually an important star. She's the evening star. Which doesn't really come back.
Mm-mm.
I don't know what the importance of that is. It doesn't seem to affect anything.
It just hit me, like, if they were going to make another film in this universe, all I would want is, like, a backstory of Yvain as a star.
Yeah, like a prequel.
Yeah, that's all I want.
Mm-hmm.
Really. She's a badass.
Oh, yeah.
I really like her as a character.
I really like how she's able to kind of bring to the forefront Tristan's kind of like errors on thinking.
Uh-huh. It's problematic. And make
fun of her. Yes. Fun of him for it.
Yeah, no, where is it? So, like, she has none of his shit, which is what I like. And here's a quote that I wrote down. This is where it got hit by a magical flying moron is one of my favorite quotes in the entire movie.
I wanna watch more of Claire Danes' work.
Yes. I will watch her or her husband.
Yeah, I know.
In anything and everything. And I just kept thinking throughout the thing, whenever she's kind of short and snippy, be like, I'd be pretty pissy too if I were a star, especially the evening star, that wasn't allowed to sleep during the daytime. That is so unfair.
That's a weird thing. I think that's just a fantastical thing because, I mean, stars come out at night because it's dark.
Like, weren't you just telling me earlier that fantasy movies make you suspend, like, belief and it's a different world and et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah.
Oh, that's what I was doing.
Yeah, that's fine. It just, I don't know.
It was part of the whimsy that I enjoyed.
It okay. is whimsy to everyone that can, words. Ah, can't talk tonight. Fuck.
I liked watching her kind of develop into her understanding how humans work when it comes to things like desire and love and emotions. You can see her growth kind of easily throughout the film as well, becoming mm-hmm. easier to relate to as a person rather than just what we think of as like this celestial rock.
I like how, and this might be a production note, I don't know. I like the glowing effect when you can, like, you can see her mood mm-hmm. and when she is feeling good and happy, and you can kind of see how it grows brighter and brighter when her, as her affection for Tristan grows brighter and brighter.
Right. Yeah. I have that as a note about lighting under cinematography. Mm. So I'll mention that as well in a little bit, mm-hmm. but that's kind of just my overall thoughts. Why did I just sound very Bostonian? My thoughts Bye. On goodbye on Evane. So, who do you have next? Because I just realized we did this out
we
of
do,
order.
We do this. Yeah, we always do this. I have Lamia next.
All right.
What a vain bitch. That's all I got.
Is that really all you have?
No, it's not all I have.
I have one note.
I know.
She's so boring.
Yeah, she's very much a typical selfish villainous witch. It's not new. It's not. Uh-huh. But finding out that she's not a main character in the books, she's a minor character, I feel like makes it a little more disappointing because
kind of, yeah.
you tried to elevate this character and you didn't.
Well, and it makes me feel like it definitely had to have been to give Michelle Pfeiffer more.
Potentially.
Because she's great. And we know that characters are developed beyond their beginning capacity all the time because mm-hmm. of the skill and talent of the actors.
And she
portraying
did great.
Them. Yeah, she's Michelle fucking Pfeiffer. Yeah. Of course she did. But it's, yeah, she's boring. Kind of what you just said. She's every witch in every movie that I've ever seen
except,
a witch be in. Except for the witch.
Except for her first role as a witch in The Witches of Eastwick, where she's basically the opposite character.
Well, you get what I'm saying, though. She's very standard, stereotypical. She's ridiculously overdramatic.
I hope you laugh at this. She only shines at the very end when she's really showing off some of her power and before she, like, finally dies. But still, she's not anything special.
Oh, God.
But, you know, like, how she dies because Evane shines really bright.
Uh-huh. Leave.
Okay, bye.
Okay, goodbye.
It's all on you. Here are my notes.
So, yeah, as a villain and as just, like, one of the main three POVs in this film, she annoyed the shit out of me, with the exception of a single part where I liked her and enjoyed her. And that was towards the very end when she's using the voodoo doll to manipulate Septimus.
Yeah, that's just a neat thing.
I thought that was pretty cool.
I really liked when it was the three of them, the three witches, which I imagine that's how it is in the books. I really liked how they all played off of each other. Like, them as, like, a unit, I enjoyed.
That, for me, was just like, of course it's three female witches, because that's always three female witches.
It's traditional fantasy.
They always want eternal youth, and it's just...
Well, so does Septimus.
But he also wants to reign eternal, and he's killed how many of his brothers?
I don't know if they say how many.
Yeah, he's... at least we see him chuck a bitch out a window. Like,
which is great.
That was pretty great. Speaking of Septimus, unless you have other notes about Lamia.
Being a dum-dum and wanting to be sadistic with a false change of heart leads her to her doom. Like, that was so dumb.
Yeah.
Just kill him. It's like every evil villain. Like, or you, like, reveal your plot and then that's how you die because you're too busy talking.
Yeah.
Like, it, as much as I enjoyed the scene, it was dumb that she let them go.
You letting me know that she's not a main character in the book makes me want to read the book even more.
Mm-hmm.
Actually. So
we should put this on the Amazon wish list now.
For sure. Yeah. Totes.
Oh, I never finished my note. I have what a for Septimus.
Ooh, Ooh, fill in the blank. Hurry, go.
You.
Association. What a what? What a...
what a dick. What a raging asshole.
What a pud.
You're
a pud. What a grease ball.
You're a pud.
You're a pud whacker.
All right. I know we said this was inappropriate. Calm down.
We've devolved. Septimus is definitely over the top.
But it's Mark Strong.
But it is Mark Strong, and that makes it so wonderful. His six brothers and his father, they're also over the top as well.
I love the interactions between him and, like, all the brothers.
Absolutely.
It's great. It's part of, like, the bickering that I mentioned earlier.
Yeah. One thing that I kind of liked about Septimus's character is there are some kind of fleeting moments where his motivation feels really deep and really true.
Because otherwise he's just another very boring villain.
Right. And this to me is what kind of tips me off as looking at him as kind of the true and real villain rather than like...
Lammy and the witches.
Yeah. Even the... I don't remember what she's called. Even the one who keeps Tristan's mother captive.
Ditchwater Sal.
Yes. Even like, because she's kind of a minor villain.
And she's a minor antagonist,
yeah.
For sure.
Yeah, I definitely consider Septimus to be the real threat and the real villain. We have others in the form of the witches, but he shows a willingness to be more cold-hearted. Although I do enjoy kind of the level of snark that comes along with him. He's not boring. And I noted that, hell, even as a dead body, he continues to be amusing.
He's ruthless and murderous, but I feel like he'd actually make a decent king. He's very dutiful, it feels.
Oh, yeah, that's a good point. I like that.
I don't know if I necessarily see him as, like, the main antagonistic force, as he eventually works with Tristan at the end.
Who would you say is the main antagonist?
I think it's supposed to be the witches.
God, I hate it. You're probably right.
We should read the book.
Yeah.
And have like a mini episode catch up, like comparison.
So here's what we think about the book versus the movie.
That would be interesting to do with other things in general. Anyway, but yeah, those are kind of my notes on him. I enjoyed his performance, but he's another typical villain. He's not special.
He comes up again in my notes, and my kind of opinion on Mark Strong's performance is almost the direct opposite of my opinion of the character, so it's in a positive way. But I almost just want to say one thing about Captain Shakespeare, and that is, like, 10/10 would recommend. He is hands down my favorite character in this film.
Yeah, I'm not surprised. There's one reason why I was trying to get you to watch this.
For him?
Yeah, because I watched you when he came on, and your face just kind of lighted up. It lit up.
It lighted.
It lit up, and you were so confused.
Did it starlight up?
No. That was bad. It was so bad. Anyway.
It was bad, and I shouldn't feel bad, but I
should,
don't.
Really should. Because you were so confused, like, almost more so than I think the average viewer.
Fuck off.
It was. It's Robert De Niro. He's, as we've kind of talked, he's kind of, like, known for being, like, this very masculine, tough dude. Right. And he is a gender-fluid individual in this movie.
I think maybe I was really confused because I didn't expect it.
Right, exactly.
And that it was so lovely. And it was almost like I was questioning, oh, like, do we get this here? This is amazing. Mm-hmm.
Although it's kind of like this movie was 2007, so I feel like LGBT portrayal was still kind of stereotypical.
Sure.
Which is, I mean, it's definitely in your face, but the acceptance of him and his crew, like, softens that. And it's like, that's a huge deal.
It is.
That they did that. And there's something in the fun facts that we'll reveal later about that.
Awesome. I have more to say about that as well later. I mean, just him as a character, he's interesting. He's dynamic. He's anything but boring. So you're looking at De Niro as a pirate captain dealing in illegal sales, leading a crew of seemingly roguish, sexist bastards. And he winds up being this brilliant, cultured theater and art-loving performer who is genuinely kind. I wish every film or story had a character as fascinating as him. Mm-hmm. And I can't really think of a higher praise than that when it comes to a character.
Mm-hmm. Vaughn and Goldman did this right with Neil.
Awesome. I loved this character. This character made the film worthwhile.
I knew it would. I've been trying to get you to watch it.
Yeah.
Because of him.
Well, I watched it eventually.
It took a podcast to get you to do it.
But I still because
you were
did.
Required.
There
it
are
was homework.
So many films that you have yet to see.
Yeah, but not as whimsical as this one.
Okay, enough with the whimsy. So this film was really difficult for me, and my notes are very short when it comes to, like, the factors of filmmaking, such as, like, production, cinematography, and editing.
I still have more on writing.
On writing? Well, shit, son, get on it.
Oh, fuck, I can tell how much you enjoyed this movie.
Sorry.
I guess, I mean, that was kind of similar to last week. I had less to say, and you had a lot to say.
Well, you have to consider, like you said last time, last week was very much a me movie.
Mm-hmm.
Very slice of life kind of indie film, and this is very much a you movie. Whimsy, fantastical, adventurous film.
Yeah. There are a lot of, like, callbacks / items that come back, and it's always something that I appreciate when... there's a weird movie quote. If you show a gun, you better fire by the end of the movie. There's a quote along those lines.
Sure.
And this movie does that a lot. The protective flower, the chain, the princess, Ferdy, stupid Ricky Gervais. And a lot of things are just interconnected very nicely, at least I think, even with the Fumi? Movie format, even though I imagine most of it comes from the source material.
Sure.
I don't know. We really need to read the book.
I mean, when you think about what you know about Neil, that makes sense to me.
But you know me. Most people don't know me. I have difficulty reading due to my attention span, but I wouldn't say that I've consumed a lot of his media.
Well, even though, you know, Coraline.
This is true.
Good Omens. To name a couple that I know you're familiar with as far as, you know, the attention that he pays to character and symbolism and callbacks and things like that, threads, so to speak. So,
just another note about the queer inclusion, and it's very just well done and is a nice addition. I really enjoy his second in command, Shakespeare's. I don't know his name. The actor, the character, I just thought he was, I really liked that character. I wish I remembered his name. The one who knows, it's the second in command, the one that, I don't know. I appreciated him as a character because he knows about the captain. Everybody knows about the captain, but he's the kind of one who's like rolling his eyes when the others are super masculine. He's just like. I feel like he's like, why do we put up with this? But I'm not going to question my captain because this is how he wants to run things.
Sure.
I don't know.
Do you include that character under queer inclusion?
Not under queer inclusion. It's just a separate note.
Okay.
It was a separate thing that I didn't make clear, apparently. So sorry.
No, nope. it's one or both of us.
Wah.
Yeah. Wah.
I thought it felt really dialogue reliant, and I don't know if that's a Neil Gaiman thing or if that's how the writers chose to handle the screenplay.
Sure.
I don't know. It's a fantastical movie. You should be showing more than you should be telling.
Yeah.
Tristan's mom. Bamf.
Bamf. Bamf.
Like, you even enjoyed her.
Yeah, I did.
And as a female character.
Yep.
Nothing else.
I mean, I think I have notes about how much I enjoy her transformation back and forth between the bird and the woman. She was a small character. But yeah, she was pretty badass.
We can move on to production design.
Yeah, sure. I mean, speaking of, I literally have her in this sentence. I love the design of the chain that keeps Una and the others captive.
Mm-hmm.
It's dainty and delicate. It's not like the hardcore chain link that we're used to
somehow,
seeing.
Like, can get really, really long.
Yeah, it can get really long. It regenerates. Mm-hmm. Like, obviously, it's cursed or it's magical or whatnot. But I really loved the design of it. It's strong, even though it's dainty. And I think I'm probably looking at it too closely and projecting my own thoughts onto it, but that's a really good kind of euphemism or a really good symbol for some of the female characters. You know, they're beautiful and they're fragile looking. I mean, they're fair. If you're thinking about like Evaine and Una, they're beautiful and fair and, you know, wispy little things. However,
the containment matches what it's containing.
I mean, they're powerful and strong.
I think a lot of the props needed to bring this fantastical world to life are really nice. I feel like they fit and they bring character to the world. Like the candle, the
yes,
what's it called? Crap.
Fuck if I know.
Shit. The royal garnet, like that blood garnet that's,
yes, that's
clear,
cool.
That, you know, when Tristan touches it, it turns to its actual color. I thoroughly enjoyed Ditchwater Sal's caravan inside and out.
Yes.
Like that, I feel like a lot of attention was paid to it.
Right. Ooh, you want to know what I really enjoyed as far as like props, aesthetics, things like that? I love the aesthetic of the set of where Evaine landed when she crashed to the planet, and her dress.
Yeah,
I was really obsessed kind of like with the color of that dress. It was very mystical and very spacey, and I liked the color as it was pretty much as close as I imagine you can get to envisioning a star as a person without being flashy and over the top.
Yeah.
There was something so simplistic about it, and I thought it just really worked.
I also really enjoyed the design of the ship and how they kind of thought out how it might capture lightning, because that's what they sell.
Right, yeah.
And then I actually enjoyed the witch's abode and the interior, the
yes.
gothic interior of that.
I thought that was really nice, too. I really, my note just says, ooh, damn.
Okay.
The age makeup on the witches on Michelle Pfeiffer. Mm-hmm. Like, if I imagine what Michelle Pfeiffer would look like as, like, a 98-year-old woman, it's probably that. I mean, she's Michelle Pfeiffer, so that's probably what she would look like if she lived to, like, 120.
That's what I was thinking. I was like, nah, way older.
Yeah, but you know what I mean. Like, it looked, it was, it was nice. I liked the age makeup. I feel like it was really well done.
I know you have a note about what we talked about when it comes to The Matrix.
Oh, shit, where is it? It is under editing, so we'll get there in a second.
It's under editing?
Yeah.
How is it under editing?
Editing.
Anyway, we'll get to it, I guess.
Oh, this is what we argued, whether or not it'd be under editing or cinematography.
Under production design.
Well, shit, this is why you're here. I just throw things wherever under these.
That's fine, they all intermix.
So I will bring that up right now. So yes, we did. We kind of argued over the special effects.
I have counter notes.
Oh, God.
They're not strong. It's okay.
Good. I felt threatened there for a moment.
We shouldn't.
So yeah, we got into a wee baby argument about how you said something right after I was done thinking, like, oh my God, this was made in 07? What the fuck are these baby elephants? Like, these effects are awful. And you were like, oh, these special effects are pretty good for 2007. And I was just like, okay, but The Matrix was made in 99. And you were like, oh, yeah, but what was the budget for The Matrix? And I was like,
I love your impersonation of me.
That's what you sound like to me now. And I was like, I don't know. And then you looked and you didn't say anything. I'm going to point this out. The argument completely died until like an hour later. And I was like, yo, I just looked into the budgets and The Matrix had a smaller budget.
By like a million.
By $2 million this. And yes, Juliet decided not to tell me she'd looked into it because she knew she was wrong.
Okay. Are you done?
For now.
Okay. The CGI is hella dated. You're correct.
Yes.
The Matrix didn't use
the Matrix.
Yep, Matrix. because I can't anything tonight.
I'm going to say earlier we're going to edit it out, but earlier we had to stop and pause and it needs to be edited because she straight up referred to Charlie Cox as cock.
And I didn't even realize.
No, she just said cock and kept going and I had to pause. But
it's because I can't talk tonight. I hate talking. And you're making me do it every week. The Matrix. used CGI sparingly. And I read a couple articles about how it's pretty unanimous that it is agreed that very specific aspects of the CGI that was used looks hella outdated as well. Like the robots. This is unanimous. I can't say that word.
Unanimous.
They use a lot of in-camera effects. So that's where all their budget went.
Okay.
This movie relies on effects way more, kind of spreading out their budget. So that's where that the discrepancy comes from. I would still say, as outdated as they look, they're okay. For Stardust.
Okay. You literally just said the effects in this movie for the time it was made are all right for this movie and this movie only.
No, for that time period.
Oh, I just have to continue to disagree because and some that's of it fine. Was so bad.
I looked at screenshots of The Matrix and I was like, that's the same.
Did you see the baby elephants in the cage?
Yeah.
They were literally like somebody copy and pasted from fucking Dumbo.
We're also watching a DVD quality movie, not Blu-ray. I'd be curious to see what the difference of quality is.
You are pressing.
I also like pushing your buttons so much.
Consider me pushed. Okay. Does that mean? So this would probably go under production design as well, instead of where I have it under editing.
Yeah, you weirdo.
Shut up. The spirits. The brothers, after they had died.
I love those guys.
Yeah, me too. I liked the aspect of them lingering. And some of the most enjoyable moments to me, I feel as though, were the spirits. And
were the comic relief.
Yeah, and they were edited in really nicely for maximum effect. Just I liked the aesthetics of them, and the look of them, and where they were edited and how they were edited in. And I thought that that was nice.
I think there was maybe one spot where I was like, you guys aren't needed, but it's not even... I couldn't even tell you where because it's not even that important of a, like, distinction.
Sure.
But yeah, that would go under production.
Okay, well, this probably would too. Just to point out that I'm not just being a dick about this movie because of how I felt about the movie overall. Mm. Some of the magical effects were really nice that I liked.
Yeah, I might have put this under something else.
I liked when all of the lights came on in the witch's kind of castle at the snap of a finger. I really liked that. The aging that happens to, I keep going back and forth, is it Lamia or Lamia?
I think it's Lamia.
To Lamia's body throughout the film. The sudden building and appearance of the inn I thought was really cool. And the transformation of Una back and forth from being a bird. I really liked that too.
Enjoyed the way that they kind of showcased from like a first person's perspective of transforming into something. Because they do it with Tristan as well when he turns into the mouse sugar glider thing.
The mess.
Yeah. With the smoke around the edges. And I'm curious as to why they don't do that in reverse though. Because they actually show his transformation from rodent to human. It's just like a thing of smoke. And maybe, they do the same with Una.
Maybe just giving different perspectives. Yeah. So cinematography-wise, I love most of the lighting.
Mm-hmm.
Whether it's starlight, candlelight, special effects lighting, the effect of the light emitting off of Yvaine, as you mentioned earlier. The lighting gave appropriate mysticism needed to make kind of every scene feel like a fantasy. So it was very mood-setting, the lighting. I thought that it was really super appropriate and well... just really well done.
Yeah, like most fantasy, there's always a lot of like wide establishing shots of the landscape and traveling, and those are really pretty.
Right.
I thought a lot of the framing was kind of boring. They don't really do anything special. I did like When the soothsayer, that scene.
Yes, that's what I have too. My single favorite moment of cinematography. No, you go ahead.
Oh, you just got so excited. You talk about it.
Well, sorry.
I refer to Septimus as Septi.
Oh, that's adorable. I have to write a fan fiction now. Oh,
Jesus.
Just to refer to him as Septi.
And it's just about Septi.
It's being just about this moment, actually.
Okay. Well, it's already written.
So. Well, you know what? It'll be an AU where it takes place in a fucking coffee shop. My single favorite moment of cinematography is when Septimus had the soothsayer toss the dice.
Really
for
high.
For the one last question before stabbing him to death. It was that straight on shot.
Yeah.
Of Mark Strong's face.
Looking pissed.
Just crystal clear, really sharp, menacing. It was the single most gorgeous shot in the entire film.
Yeah, you like them CGI runes?
No, it wasn't even the dice. It was literally, and sure, like, Mark isn't exactly, like, my type of dude aesthetically.
Mm-hmm. Which is funny because he's British.
Okay, not every Brit. This is an argument discussion for later. Like, he's amazing. But it was just the beautiful way that split second was shot that, like, took my breath away. And that will be the moment that stands out to me when I think about this film in the future.
I think those are my notes on that.
Did you have anything else to say about that moment? Or did you, like, just...
It was really enjoyable. I really liked that scene. Yeah. I really liked from start to finish, not just the specific shot that you were talking about. Like, kind of just the whole thing. Because that was shot in Iceland.
Oh.
Iceland is pretty, and you've got, like, the nice contrasting colors between, like, the ice and the water and then, like, what they're wearing, and it's just, I don't know, I really like, yeah, I just like a lot about that scene.
Yeah, it was really nice. Mm-hmm. I barely have anything for music. It was there.
Oh, wow, we did this in a... did you say all your notes about editing?
I did, I'm sorry.
Oh, because those were all production design.
Yep, sorry.
This is kind of back to the beginning with direction. There's a lot of jumping around subject wise in the beginning, but they're trying to establish so much in the beginning to get the ball rolling. The pacing was really weird to me for, like, the first half of the movie. Did you feel that at all? Or
it didn't stand out to me as being odd. No.
Some of the transitions were really cheesy. I know there's another example, but the one that I wrote down was, like, when the moon turns into the shiny coin.
Ah.
Like, I was like, all right, this isn't, like, the early 90s. Come on. I thought it was really weird that they included the landing of the ship into the water. Like, I didn't understand what purpose that scene served. Do you know what I'm talking about?
I do.
Do you care?
I don't know what to say. Like, I was neutral about a lot of things in this movie, and that was just another thing that didn't really strike me as one thing or another.
Yeah, I didn't know what purpose it served, and it was like a random act of joy, but we had just gotten that in the scene before with Tristan and Evain.
Sure.
They got wet for no reason in that scene. Like,
maybe that was the point.
It looked like idiot. Robert De Niro looked like an idiot trying to land this stupid airplane.
Well, you mentioned whimsy. Maybe it was just a building of whimsy.
Meh.
I don't know.
For music, it's just very typical fancy. A lot of fancy fantasy. My God. A lot of horns, big sound, very grandiose, a bit over dramatic at times, but that kind of seems to, like, play into the tone. Breathe.
I don't know. It's so funny. Just you. A lot of horns.
Yeah, fantasy.
The brass section was just a swelling.
No, it's French horn specifically.
Yeah, the music was there.
Oh.
Don't choke on your tea. the music was there and swelling and appropriate. At times, I actually felt like I was a little bit distracted and my senses felt very overwhelmed. Mm. I have a really funky sense of hearing.
Yes, you do.
I do. And sometimes film can overwhelm my sense of hearing, and I felt the music do that. But I was really pretty neutral about it. It was fantasy music for a fantasy film, and I don't like see myself looking for the soundtrack on Spotify. Just whatever.
Performances?
Oh, babyface Charlie Cox. That's
kind of where this I think this film shines, is in the performances.
Sure, I would agree.
I love the old guard at the wall. He's fucking hilarious.
Yeah, he was pretty great.
He's so funny.
He, you know what thought just crossed my mind? You want to talk about character development.
Gonna guard this wall for 80 years and then realize, oh no, there are things on the other side that could come through. Bye.
Well, I'm also just thinking Tristan and his father. Mm-hmm. Like, fool me once, shame on me. Fool me twice, oh no you don't, motherfucker.
I like how Tristan got his ass kicked.
Yeah, exactly. That's what I'm saying. Tristan, just Charlie. It was a little hard for me to watch him and keep a straight face because it was mainly, like I said, because I know him as Matt Murdock. And he kept reminding me so much of a strange mix of, like I said, a young Robert Sean Leonard, who a lot of people know from Dead Poets Society and as Dr. Wilson from House. And Jason Ralph, who's Quentin on The Magicians. Like, a mix of those two. He was charming. He was boyish, sincere. Kind of that kind, friendly face, which is needed for a role like this. So it was good casting.
He was picked because he could be the dork and then turn into the suave hero.
I can see that.
It's quoted somewhere.
I can also see that as being Robert Sean Leonard and Jason Ralph. So I just...
Jason.
I kept thinking of young Charlie Cox as an amalgamation of those two actors, which is not a bad thing. It's a very complimentary bit of praise, actually.
My note is that Charlie's just such a little nerd. That's all I got.
He is. He's so cute. Just kept giggling manically. He's very
charming, especially towards the end of the movie.
Yeah. Charming is definitely the main description.
Claire is just so snarky and funny in the beginning, and I really enjoy watching her character evolve. She makes this role seem very effortless, which I think she just kind of does in general. Mm-hmm. Her confession of love to Tristan is just so good.
Yes.
It's like a highlight of the film, I think.
I also made note of that. She's just so delightful. She's enjoyable. She's this, like, ethereal, beautiful star who cops an amazing amount of attitude, which I just love yes. That balance. I really liked her physical performances in this. Particularly, she's trying to strike Dishwater Sal when, you know, Dishwater Sal can't sense her existence. And it's such a...
Dishwater.
What was I... I was calling her Dishwater.
Probably the same thing in this instance. But
Dishwater Sal.
Yes.
Thank you. She couldn't sense her existence, so really it was Claire just, like, swinging at the air around her, and it was so ridiculous, but it was so fantastic, and physical comedy usually doesn't get me, but it really did. I really loved that. She's very
expressive.
She committed.
Oh, yeah. She has great command of her face as well. Like, some of the... Your quote from earlier, flying stupid moron, just
yes.
She's not only emoting with her voice, but her face and her body.
Yes. and she's so particularly lovely during that scene, as you mentioned, when she's speaking to Tristan, when he's like the little baby rodent mousy thing.
Mm-hmm.
And just perfect casting was perfect with Claire Danes.
I feel like there's a lot of big names in this.
Oh, for sure.
Like, under the radar film.
Absolutely.
Mm-hmm. It's always interesting when that happens. I feel like we've brought that up several times. I've probably brought it up several times.
Which is nice. Mark Strong.
Mm-hmm. Robert De Niro, Michelle Pfeiffer.
Yeah.
Claire Danes.
Yeah. What did you think of Mark Strong's performance?
I always enjoy Mark Strong, even if he's in a minor role.
Yeah.
I feel is very chameleon-like in his roles. He's not a character actor, but he's a character actor.
You do get excited to see him.
I do.
He is one of the few that you have a strong reaction to.
Mm-hmm. I don't even know why.
Because he's Mark Strong. Yeah. He's always fun to watch.
He is.
His performance was probably one of my favorite aspects of watching. Because it was over the top. It was fantastical. And just seeing him with the long flowing locks when I'm used to the, you know, the buzz cuts or the baldness, to be frank, it was perfect. Endlessly amusing. He has the face of a villain and the maneuvers of a villain.
And he often plays one.
Yeah, and like the actions of a villain. And he pulls off this character so perfectly as dislikable and kind of pathetic. And I dug it. And also, again, with the physical performance, particularly for the choreography he learned for the necromancy scene.
Oh, my God.
That would have taken forever.
Well, I wonder how much of it is him and how much of it is a stunt double.
Oh, don't steal this from me.
Well, some of it has to be him just because of how where the camera
on,
is. Yeah, but, like, still.
Yeah.
That's a lot of effort all around.
Right.
So.
I loved that scene so much. That's kind of what I think. I made the note for Claire, but I think that of the whole cast, kind of bouncing back to what you said, they just all committed.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's so important, is when you have an entire ensemble that's willing to fully commit.
Yeah, and I think that's something that you have to do in this genre. And I think that's a reason that a lot of fantasy films might not do as well, because
right.
you gotta go big or go home, because that's it. That's what fantasy is, I feel, almost.
Right. So, okay, so I just finished saying that. However, I almost immediately contradict myself with some of the notes I have down for Michelle Pfeiffer. I typically really enjoy her, and she was fine.
Mm-hmm.
Like, she was fine in this. I think it really came down to me not being able to, like, compartmentalize how much I dislike the character from her performance. I just kept thinking, like, Michelle, why? She's a great actress. This was a role where I felt like many other people could have kind of stepped into it, and it would have been just as fine, if that makes sense.
Well, I mean, under, what was it, the actor notes, Vaughn had to get all these big names before
right.
he could get his no-name lead.
I don't know. And while I definitely agree that she committed to it, so I'm not exactly countering myself here, I also, for some reason, got this gut feeling that she wasn't exactly having as much fun as everybody else. Does that make sense?
Yeah, maybe.
And I could be totally off base. This could have been the role of a lifetime for her that she enjoyed. But it just, I didn't feel like she, or maybe it's just the character that lacked joy.
Mm, yeah.
I don't know.
I really liked the character in her at the end of the film when they're in the witch's abode and just kind of everything's exploding.
Sure, yeah. I mean, the character has highlights.
Just another note about Robert. Just, you know, seeing this man's man playing this very feminine, queer individual
yes.
was wonderful.
I just have that this might be my favorite De Niro role. Honestly, I mean, of course, I think of De Niro and I think immediately of Taxi Driver. And I'm not saying that this was his most... what's the word I'm looking for? Prestigious.
Or career defining.
Exactly. But this might be my favorite. He had so much fun. It's shown through as genuine. I liked his aesthetic. This might be the most attracted to Robert De Niro I've ever been. Even before kind of like the gender fluidity bit. Just the short cropped silver fox kind of hair. Like, I dug it. And I kind of looked at this as him having a full ability of fulfilling two roles in the film perfectly, where this character is kind of fulfilling two different roles, his genuine self and the self that he shows most often to those around him.
To protect that reputation.
Exactly, that reputation. and I just was squealing over him so much.
Yes, you were.
The absolute highlight for me.
She was.
I was. Do you have any random notes before we get to our interesting factoids?
My first question is what's the letter in the beginning, which is in our interesting factoids. So we will see what the letter is.
Ooh, okay.
It's nothing special.
Aww.
so many babies in this. This movie is obviously 2007. everybody looks so young.
Yes.
It was so weird.
Yes.
Watching. I love, you know me and names. I love the naming scheme of the princes. Primus.
Oh, yeah.
Secundus, Tertius, Septimus.
Yep.
Yeah. That's like, pretty great. I loved it. I don't think I included it in the notes, but like the character design and like the clothing design of all the princes incorporates their number into their wardrobe.
That's really nice.
Like Septimus has the number 7 on all of his buttons.
Oh, I like that.
I wish I would have. There's so many interesting facts. I kind of had to, you know, cut some for time's sake, but it was something about their numbers are written in Arabic or something along those lines on all of their clothing.
Cute.
Mm-hmm.
I like that a lot, actually. I like that detail.
Poor Bernard.
Oh my god, poor Bernard.
Poor Bernard. The little man, goat, man, then woman.
Yep.
Then man again.
Poor Bernard.
I don't think you've ever seen The Tenth Kingdom.
No.
But it was a miniseries back in the day that came on like 4 VHS tapes. It was like a TV miniseries. I fucking love it as well. It's campy fantasy. This reminds me of that a lot. I need to find it and own it so I can watch it. You don't have to watch it with me.
Thank you.
Why are Ditchwater Cell's palms blue?
This is a great question.
Uh-huh.
Who can we email to find out the answer?
No.
Like, is the director available?
Oh, in our interesting facts, you will have your question about the prince's blue blood answered.
Ooh, yes.
Yep.
Good.
Anyway,
A plus.
Yes. It's also really random, speaking of dead princes, why is the bathtub with Primus left? When the inn's torn down, why is he left in the bathtub? Like, wouldn't it just be him?
Yeah. Speaking of questions, why would they not just build the broken piece of wall? The guard is only at the broken piece of wall. Why the fuck would they not just patch that bitch up and like...
Maybe they've tried and then... I don't know.
That bothered the weird fantasy shit out of me.
Trope rules. I don't know.
And like, also, you're telling me that that wall was really high enough everywhere else to keep people in and out? It bothered me so badly.
Those are probably the only villages near the wall ever. I don't know. Ask Neil.
Yo, Neil. Maybe we should read the book.
Fuck. Why does Una not age?
Yeah, that's a good question. I wonder if she doesn't age some sort of when magic. She's the bird.
Yeah, I thought that too.
Yeah.
She must be a bird a lot.
What's nice about fantasy is you can often be like, magic.
Yeah, I mean, I just use that as an explanation in general in life.
Oh.
I thought having Ian McKellen as the narrator was just so random and unneeded, but I love him, so it didn't matter as much.
You know my feelings about narration.
What?
I'm not a big fan of having narrators.
Oh, yeah. Well, you said you were okay with narrators. It's just when they, like, it's too much, like, exposition and not like...
I don't...
Because he's only, like, in the beginning and
that's
end.
The thing, is it necessary for there to even be a narrator?
I think in the beginning. Maybe not at the end.
I don't know. See, at the end is where I feel it more necessary to wrap up the story.
I just randomly thought of Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy.
Anyways.
That has narration. It's not random.
That will be an entire episode all on its own.
Though. I can't wait.
I know, that'll be a good
one.
We
haven't watched that together.
We have not. That'll be fun.
Yes.
The goats, however, that was great. The actor Mark Williams, who played Billy the Innkeeper, his mannerisms were well timed and funny. And as I mentioned earlier, as someone who's not really a fan of physical comedy, I just really applaud the ability of the actor and the character to
jump
amuse
up on a
me
bar.
To no end. Yes, it was so fantastic. And the whole time, once again, this is somehow the second reference that I've made to this movie that I absolutely hate, but it made me think of The Witch. It made me think of Black Phillip. Like, when he's on his hind legs in The Witch.
I think you secretly like that movie in, like, an ironic way.
I really don't, though.
I know.
I like that movie because I don't like the movie. I like every opportunity that I'm able to make fun of how terrible that movie really was. That should also be an episode.
Yep.
There
are good things about that movie, but moving on.
I hate how Ricky Gervais just like shows up.
I like when he can't speak and just clucks like a chicken, though.
See, I don't. That was so fucking annoying. I literally have written down the whole thing with his character was annoying, including the clucking like a chicken bit. it's so obnoxious. And
I feel like that's just kind of what Ricky Gervais deserves.
I am completely neutral about Ricky Gervais as a human being. Completely new. I know he's pretty controversial, especially recently. Completely neutral about him as a human being. Have no feelings about him. But his face annoyed me. Like, he popped up and I was like, why is this Ricky Gervais right now?
In the book then.
Yeah, I don't know. The whole thing, the clucking, everything about that fell over the top, ridiculous to me. I hated it. Sorry.
I wonder if you'll like the book then.
Maybe. And also my last random note is all caps. Henry Cavill.
Fuck, I forgot about him.
What is your hair / facial hair / inability to wink, bro?
You just like slammed on the desk and I don't know if I'm gonna be able to edit that out.
Leave the slam.
Okay.
I meant it.
It was so funny when I was looking up the cast and I was like, Henry Cavill, who the fuck does he play? He plays Humphrey. Oh my God. Ooh. And then he shows up. I died.
Yeah, I also died. It was pretty great.
It was great. I enjoy his face.
Same. All right, let's get to our interesting factoids.
Yar. So the locations, it was filmed all over England and Scotland, with one location being in Wales, and then there was a couple of locations in Iceland. Vaughn was supposed to film, or had X-Men The Last Stand, which if I remember is not a good one. It's the third one in the original trilogy, I think. Anyway, he stepped away from that movie, and that was when he was actually able to jump on board of this movie. So he almost didn't do this movie. De Niro's gender-fluid pirate was definitely the film's riskiest move, but De Niro's cross-dressing comedic approach paid off, and it set the irreverent tone for the film as a whole. Stardust won the GLAAD Media Award in 2008 for Outstanding Film Wide Release.
Oh, that makes me so happy. Mm-hmm. Oh, that makes me so happy. do you know if this character is identified as a cross-dresser or as gender fluid?
I don't.
Okay, because both terms have been used throughout this episode and
I'm not sure. Okay. That's just the sources that I've found.
Sure.
Just,
Okay.
Indicate both of those.
Okay. Just wanting to point out, for anyone who's listening, if you're interested, those are two very different terms. Mm-hmm. So Google is your friend. But I'm so glad that they won a GLAAD Award. Mm-hmm. That just like brightens my soul.
I did include this. All princes wear clothing with a pattern spelling out their number in Roman numerals, composed by smaller Arabic numerals.
Nice. I really do like that.
Furthermore, Septimus wears a vest with several with the number 7 on each button. The three witches share their name with a demonic creature from Greek mythology, which I pointed Lamia out to you.
Yes.
As a mythical creature. I didn't know it was demonic, but Lamia and Mormo were demons who ate children.
Cute.
The former being a former lover of Zeus, the god king, and Empusa was a creature sent by the goddess Hecate to eat travelers.
But did she eat children travelers?
Perhaps. I feel like Hecate is Roman? Huh. Interesting. Anyway.
Captain Shakespeare's flying boat is called Caspertine, named after Matthew Vaughn's two children, Caspar and Clementine.
Mm-hmm.
That's adorable. The letter the scientist sent to Dunstan, Nathaniel Parker, reads, "Dear Sir, thank you for your inquiry concerning the existence of another world beyond the wall surrounding your village. In our opinion, the hypothetical existence of such a gateway would run contrary to all known laws of science. Subsequently, in the opinion of my esteemed colleagues and myself, The idea may be safely dismissed as merely colorful rural folklore. I thank you again for your inquiry and hope that our conclusion will enable you to proceed with your life. Yours faithfully. Ah, you said that it's not all that important, but I like knowing what that letter said.
I do too. I was really
curious about it.
I enjoy knowing what it says finally, but it's just, I don't know. I don't know if I was expecting more out of it or what.
I mean, I guess that makes sense in relation to knowing who the letter writer was. And interesting. And finally, the princes, when killed, are all shown to bleed blue blood. I can't wait to read the rest of this fact because this was a question that I had. This is a joke hinting at their nobility, as those of royal heritage were said to have blue blood in their veins rather than red. As the princes are of royal heritage, they are literally blue bloods. This may also have allowed the filmmakers to depict greater violence on screen while maintaining a lower age-appropriate rating. That is literally what I was wondering, if that's what that was for. Mm. Were these from IMDb?
I believe most of them were, yes.
Okay. Yeah, the I was thinking as I was watching that it might have been to get that that rating. Was this PG or PG-13?
I imagine PG-13.
It just made me think of fucking period commercials. Like the blue, like pad and tampon liquid is all I can think
about. Grow up, executives.
Grow up. Let the blue bloods bleed red.
Yep.
Continuing on. All right. What was your favorite part?
I kind of already mentioned them. I really, really enjoyed Evane's love confession, and then you brought it up, the fight between dead Septimus and Tristan.
Yeah.
Just that it was always something that I thoroughly enjoyed watching. I don't enjoy watching Septimus die, but the way that he dies is neat.
Mm-hmm.
And you were super, like, intrigued by it.
Yeah.
I was kind of watching you.
It was really well filmed and nicely done, and it was original.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Yeah. Hands down, favorite part was when Septimus and his men tried to take over Shakespeare's ship and crew. Captain Shakespeare is getting down in his quarters, dressed all lovely, dancing like the theater nerd that he really is. His men not only protect him from getting killed, but they don't seem overly fazed by seeing him in feminine garb. And their response brought literal tears to my queer little eyes. It's such a lovely sentiment. You have one of the pirates saying, "Well, we always knew you were a whoopsie." Followed by, you know, "You'll always be our captain. And that general acceptance was just so heartwarming. I actually feel like I'm tearing up again, like, right now thinking about
it. Oh, that's a first. You have yet to do that on here.
You know what? I'm okay. I'm not going to actually cry. That'll be for next week.
Oh, goddammit.
You know I'll probably cry next week. What about your least favorite part?
Boring villains.
Yeah, any scene with the witches.
I know you hated the witches. I didn't hate them like you did, but they're just boring.
Yeah, I couldn't find myself able to care about their plight. I wanted to be watching any other storyline whenever the focus was on the witches.
Apparently this movie's kind of considered like a low-key cult classic.
That doesn't, like, just shock or surprise me.
As I told you, it's on syndication a lot.
Yeah.
And Charlie Cox in an interview was like, "I don't know why people like it." But Matthew Vaughn set out to make a film with, like, a broad kind of, like, appeal.
Yeah.
And I think he succeeded in that. And I am there with the Wikipedia article is quoted saying that it has charming characters, and I think it does, and I think that comes down to the performances and yeah.
I can agree with that.
More interesting facts.
Yes. Out of 10, what's your score?
I changed it after talking to you.
Did you?
7.5.
7.5. All right. See, for you, that makes more sense to me. I rated it a 6.
Mm-hmm.
It's kind of my lowest rated thus far. Not my jam. Performances were great. Some of the cinematography was lovely. Some of the story was lovely. Lots of things that I dug about it. But when we got around to that second watch, man, it was on my mind all day. Like, can we please watch this at 1.5 speed? Like, I just don't want to. It's not necessarily a bad thing. I'm glad that I watched it. I'm glad that I saw it. Especially for Captain Shakespeare.
Mm-hmm.
I mean,
that was the primary reason I wanted you to watch it.
And I appreciate it.
I love that movie. I used to watch it, like, all the time in college when I was doing work.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. All right, so do you feel competent? I know you're competent. No, I'm not going to ask that. Do you feel confident enough to drop our socials?
No.
Find us on Facebook at facebook.com/screenteapodcast.
Twitter is screenteapod.
Shoot us an email at thescreenteapodcast@gmail.com.
And then you can find us online at our website at screenteapodcast.com.
Also, next week, we are having a friend visit us from out of state, and she has agreed to kind of guest star next week's episode. So if you would like to have another perspective, if you'd like to hear another perspective, it should be fun for a very serious film that we've been looking forward to covering for a very long time.
It might make it easier since this is like a little bit of a struggle film to watch, I feel.
Oh, see, I disagree. Not a struggle film to watch. Love it. I can watch this movie every day. But I am also a big crier and don't mind crying every day. But anyways, Jules, my lovely lady, tea check.
My tea has been gone.
Oh, and my tea has grown cold.
Wow. So,
until next week.
Bye.
Bye.